How is your soul, by the way, tonight, friends? That's a very, very unpopular word. I'm sorry I brought that up. Does anyone actually have a soul? We could. You, of course, are aware that many of the philosophers of the 19th century and even the 18th century argued endlessly as to the location of the soul, where it was located, in the body. And one group of philosophers held that it was located in the pineal gland. I hold for that. Another group held for the pancreas. And then there was another group that held for somewhere else. But that's another story, and we're not going to get into the Freudians at this time. We're going to save that for next semester. We got a lot of stuff for next semester. Oh, together now, gang. I knew it. I'm going to sleep out in the kitchen with my peace in the hall. Oh, I'm going to drink muddy water, baby, until you come next to me. Oh, I'm going to sleep in the kitchen with my peace in the hall. Going to drink muddy water down that old rotten, rotten, crummy, stinking river. Going to drink muddy water, because you done left me alone. Very exciting. Any more Americana, we would be more than pleased to. That comes out of the tradition, you know. Speaking of it coming out, I can just see already now, endless little old days. Dear Mr. Shepherd, my husband Charles and I enjoy your program, but when you begin to sing and do those awful, noisy, terrible things, we just have to rush to the radio and turn down our set. I can't understand why you do these things. You're continually... I love it when you read poetry and you sing quiet music. I'll never forget... Hold it. Terrible thing here. It's separating the sheep from the goats. You know, speaking of goats, would someone please look up soul for me? Would you please look that word up? I wish I had this this Underbridge dictionary. Do you know what the actual definition of soul is? That's S-O-L-E, soul. I'd like to... speaking of soul, the other day, I don't know whether any of you have seen this. There's some very mysterious things afoot. Very mysterious. Do you know Bryant Park at all, Ed? No. You're completely missing my point. Do you know where Bryant Park is? At 41st there and 6th Avenue? Well, there's a great big H&H sign there. You know that big Horn and Hardart sign? Well, if you look right next to that sign, way up there on this billboard, right next to the Horn and Hardart sign, written in great big black letters, is the very simple, sneaky, significant slogan. Now, it may be a political slogan, I don't know. All it says is a simple two-letter phrase, which is right out of George Orwell. I'm going along, you know, and I look up in George Horn and Hardart, and it says, mother helps best, or the best thing for mother. What is the Horn and Hardart slogan? Less work for mother. Yes, less work for mother. And I'm walking along, and the less work, and a lot of mothers are staggering around. I don't know whether you know the neighborhood at all, but it's a pretty interesting neighborhood. And I come along there, and I see this big sign, and I glance up, and there it is, right there next to the old H&H sign, is that simple. I think we need dramatic music here, Eddie. Simple dramatic music. Tung, tung, tung. The simple slogan hung over the city. Be suspicious. Yeah, that's what it says. Yeah, that's what it says. Just some be suspicious. Is there anybody out there who's suspicious tonight, huh? Quack, 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 quack. Hold it there, Eddie. That's enough. That's enough. Enough of that suspicious music. Oh, yeah, there are all kinds of interesting things in the wind. Be suspicious. Wouldn't that make a great bumper slogan? Of our time. Just be suspicious. Well, of course, there's a lot of reasons to be suspicious because there's a lot of wild things going on all over the place. I'm still getting reports. Of course, I believe that last Christmas was a historic Christmas. It marked a whole new phase in, I don't want to call it a Christmas celebration. What is it? It's a whole new phase in American culture, this past Christmas. And I think that things are beginning to develop very nicely. Ed, would you please give me mysterious music, and I will put on my Westbrook Fanvori's voice. 900 spectators see huge pile of Yule trees burn. Delayed one day by high winds, the burning of the greens made its gigantic flaming appearance before an estimated 900 persons Sunday night at the Hill School, Far Fields, New Jersey. Ignited by Mayor John B. Hartenstein, Jr., the 25-foot pile of 3,700 Christmas trees was reduced to ashes in an hour and a half as lively music blared from a sound truck. The tree burning came a day late as high winds forced a postponement Saturday night. George Gentert, director of the event for the JCs, considered the tree collection and burning a definite, and we quote, success. And he said that the JCs would sponsor the spectacular spectacle next year. He added that the group may stage the drive a few days later next year, probably 12 days after the Yuletide holiday, in order to gain more trees so that higher flames could reach to the skies. Gantert said Beto Fire Chief Richard Moser considered the blaze one of the biggest he had seen. 900 people gathered to watch. At one point, the burning trees sent flames 60 feet into the crisp night air. Spectators see huge pile of Yule trees burn in symbolic display. Be suspicious. Be. Keep your eye peeled. Don't believe anyone. Look back over your shoulder now. Someone may be following. Whoa, whoa, whoa. I'm sorry, Mr. Shepard. You could have been so dignified on your radio program if you decided to do it, because otherwise you're such a nice person. Now, speaking of dignified, nice people, this is WOR, your dignified, nice station. And we'll be here until midnight being dignified and nice. And we have some promo spots here, which means freebies. Let's see. Here's one right here. The Lighthouse, the New York Association for the Blind, if you would like to contribute, New York 22, New York. We have another one here. Federated Handicap. What's this one? If you have a job vacancy, remember to call Federation's Placement Service, telephone Chelsea 29050. That's the Federation of the Handicapped. And here is one for the Foster Parents Plan. If you're interested in adopting a child, box 944, New York 8. That's the Foster Parents Plan. Now, let's see. Oh, here's one that is not a freebie. It is the Mandarin House. And a couple of nights ago, I went to the Mandarin House and got myself bombed out of my skull on, what is that dish? It is twice cooked pork, but there's something else that they have there. A kind of sauteed fish that is in tiny chips with fantastic sauce. Oh, boy. Well, anyway, I'm sitting there getting myself primed to the gills. And I realize that among the world's, I think most people in the world, actually, are very, very unadventurous when it comes to eating. It's the truth. I don't know why Greeks, when they come to America, immediately rush to a Greek restaurant to eat bad Greek food. With all the great hamburgers we've got available here in America, and all the exotic things like hot dogs that are available, they go and eat Greek. You know, what is this? So I would like to suggest, if your life is getting dull and you would like an extra thrill or two and you'd like to get mad, I would suggest you visit Mandarin House. It is true. People are very, very conservative when it comes to food. And if you have not tried Mandarin food, you haven't really tried Oriental food. Not really Oriental food. And there are two great Mandarin House restaurants, one on 13th between 6th and 7th, and the other one is up on 2nd Avenue just north of 57th Street. And very shortly they will be open. Very shortly, by the way, they're going to start celebrating New Year's, Chinese New Year's. This is upcoming is the Year of the Dragon, which is supposed to be a spectacular year. Yeah. And I'm going to go down and celebrate it. Dragon meat. So that's Mandarin House. They have a bar. Now, that's it. Oh yes. Speaking of being suspicious, the moments come. Have you ever had a feeling when you're walking along? I had one of those eerie moments today of a kind of remembered emotion. Now, I don't mean, the most common thing, of course, is to be sitting in a place and suddenly you get the illusion that you know what's about to happen, that you've seen this scene before, and it's just a brief momentary thing. It's very eerie while it happens, and then after it passes, you can say, oh, well, and you try to think, well, now, why did I know that? And you never can quite understand why it was. You know that thing, Ed. Of course, you realize that little thing that happens to people. It happens to everybody. And that little thing is the basis of about 95 religions. It's the basis of about 500 different metaphysical philosophies. It's the basis of fist fights. It's the basis of many a swami and guru who operates a little place off of 47th Street on the west side. And these things have bugged people forever. But have you ever had the feeling, or at least recently, I know that you've had the feeling, oh, here, let's see, soul is now defined. Soul. Soul. Let's see. I wonder if this fits anything that you have here. I'm glad to see this. Now, wait a minute. Informing, is that word informing, dear? Your writing sometimes has a tendency to spread out. The N's and the U's and all of those, the W's all look like little things, just little waves. Let's see, informing the inner man's mind and emotion. All right, here is the soul. Now, we will see whether we have a soul. I think I need I need some kind of good soul music here. Would you please look in my 50 fantastic moments of mediocre music? And I think you'll find some good soul music there. Just drag it out. Soul music is... that's not really soul music. Now, don't confuse the Waltz of the Flower. No, I think soul music would have to be Beethoven. I, I suspect it's Beethoven. Of course, unfortunately, the Beethoven that we have with us always has a hang-up. So, Ed, if you'll set him about a line and a half in there, he won't get hung up on that first big phrase. Yes, all right, all set. Soul music. All ready? All right. Yes, that's soul music. Soul. Boom, ba, ba, boom. An entity conceived as the essence, substance, animating principle, or actuating cause of life, or of the individual life, especially of individual life manifested in thinking, willing, and knowing. It is regarded as immortal and separable from the body at death. The physical or spiritual principle in general, especially as informing the universe, man's moral and emotional nature. That's the soul. Yeah, that sounds familiar. I remember I had that. I had one of those. I remember Miss Shields one time saying that to us in second grade. We just finished. What happened was there was a line in Little Orphan Annie. It was a line that was in Raggedy Ann, Raggedy Andy. I think Andy, when he discovered the balloon fairies coming down from the trees, riding their balloons, said, "Pon my soul." And Miss Shields used to give us tests on various points of interest along the route in the Raggedy Ann and Raggedy Andy stories. Yes, now what did the balloon fairy say when he saw Raggedy Ann taking off her shoes at the lake to go wading in after frogs? Well, you would write down, "Oh my, there is someone wading after frogs." You write that down. Well, one of the kids, I think it might have been Joshua, asked Miss Shields, what is a soul? He came from a very atheistic family. Oh boy, I could tell you some stories about that crew, but that's another time. And he says, "What is a soul, Miss Shields?" Miss Shields then said, "An entity conceived as the essence, substance, animating principle, or actuating cause of life itself." Well, that kept us going until sixth grade. And, of course, it slowly died down. And we got other problems now. But along that scenic route, this scenic route of existence, have you had recently the feeling of a memory of a particular emotion? Well, let me tell you a little weirdo that happened to me today. A little weirdo, yes. I am meeting a guy, and we were walking along, and we came to the Medical Arts Building. Do you know the Medical Arts Building up on 57th Street and 6th Avenue? Well, this is a very official building where they have all kinds of official places that have to do with medicine. They have a hospital and all. It's a very official place, and x-rays and all that stuff. And right in the lobby of the Medical Arts Building, there is a line of telephone booths. Now, to those of you who do not live in New York, a telephone booth is the very lifeblood of a New Yorker. One of the more amusing sights is to look along Madison Avenue. They have these little glass phone booths about every two blocks. As far as you can look, there is a gesticulating, angry phone caller. and there is a drunken phone caller who has fallen asleep in the booth with the thing hanging down, and he's laying with his head on the little shelf there. This is a common New York sight. One of the more interesting New York sights that you really don't see outside of New York is the sight where they have the phone booths in some drugstores plastered up against the window. And you see people in various fetal shapes. Yes, well, you look in through the window. Haven't you seen those people? You haven't. I'm sorry, honey. You don't get around New York. Well, you walk along, and there in the window is about nine people all bent over in the telephoning or fetal position. We should bend over. The little phone is cradled on one ear, and their other hand is over the other ear, and they're sort of leaning over, and you can see a whole bunch of them like little shrimp in a can. They're New Yorkers, all in touch with home base, and all, of course, in the prenatal or fetal position, which... That's a very dangerous one. Have you noticed the phone company's new motto? Well, the new motto, it hit me right today after I had made an unsuccessful phone call, Ed. I made a business phone call, and I got this guy on the phone. You know, I figure I'm going to close the deal. And so I dialed the number, and I said, "Hello, Charlie? It's old Shep." And there's a brief note. He says, "Yeah?" I says, "Yeah, how is it?" He says, "You don't have to ask, man. You laid another egg. Plunk, right there." Well, I said, "Ha, ha, ha, well, I just..." another silence. Oh, let's have lunch, huh? He's gone. I got his girl. Oh, well, she says okay. Well, that isn't exactly what I was looking for. Well, right in front of me, after I'd laid this bomb in the phone booth, there is a line on the wall in clear phone company print. It says, "On the telephone, you'll get action." Come on, bring up some action music, Ed. On the phone, you get action, I'll say. Indeedy mo. Well, anyway, I hate to digress, but I'm with this guy, see? So he says, uh-oh. He looks at his watch. Oh my God, I got to make a phone call. So he rushes in, and in the lobby there of the Medical Arts Building, there's about 9 phone booths. They're all, and as befitting the kind that would be in the Medical Arts Building, they're a kind of different color than they are anyplace else. They have a sort of vaguely woodeny color. They don't look like stainless steel like they look in other. No, they're painted a kind of a casket color, you know. It's very strange. So, that's true. Place is very symbolic. WOR, believe me, is at war with the world. It is no coincidence that all our walls are battleship gray around here. No coincidence at all. Believe me, we drift in the right direction here. But nevertheless, I go into this place with this guy, seeing we're standing in the lobby. Well, there's about 95 different elevators coming down from the Medical Arts place. And you see guys hobbling in and guys with bandages and guys with patches over their eyes and little old ladies are going in and out. And I'm just standing there minding my own business. The guy's in there on the phone when suddenly the thing opens up there, one of the elevators, and 3 nurses get out. And they're obviously nurses. They're knocking off for their coffee break. And 3 of them advance towards me, and they're wearing the little white things, you know, the little white hats. And right next is the Rikers. You know they're going to go in the Rikers. So the 3 of them are coming out. They're lighting up cigarettes coming out of the Medical Arts Building. They're lighting up the cigarettes. And one of the nurses, a fantastic little blonde chick with this little white hat on her head, you know, with a little blue tab and a very official-looking, fantastic little nurse comes out with sort of overtones of Romy Schneider, you know, little overtones of Brigitte Bardot and a little touch of Doris Day and the little Lolita, and it's all there, you know, and that unbelievable attraction of the white uniform. I think I just cannot describe to you. Men know this. I don't know whether women know it, but it is the indescribable erotic pull of the white uniform. Yes. Look at Ed's glasses suddenly lighting up. It's the first time in a month. Well, yes, I don't know whether women know this or not, but it is definitely true. I would suggest that any chick that's having trouble get herself a white uniform. Believe me. And so I'm standing there, you know, I'm minding my own business, and I can hear my friend in there on the phone. He says, "No, hurry up!" And I'm trying to look like I don't, you know, I'm not. Oh, it's awful to be around where somebody's having a knockdown battle with somebody, and it's very embarrassing, and it's a very private battle, you know, that kind. "Well, I told you to get rid of this!" And they're yelling. And have you ever gone into a phone booth, and in the next phone booth there is a fantastic private conversation that's being held at top screaming voice? Oh. And there's another thing about telephones. Have you ever sat in there and dialed somebody? And you're waiting for your number. You see them finding, and they pick it up, and they say, "Okay, just a minute, we'll get them." And you're sitting there on the phone, and it's silence. And then suddenly you begin to hear a subterranean conversation. It's leaking from the other wire. And you start listening real carefully, and you catch 1 or 2 words. Pittsburgh. And you're waiting, and then all of a sudden, on comes Charlie, and he says, "Hello?" And just, "Shh, just a minute." "So what's the matter with you?" You figure any minute now you're going to get the terrible lascivious secrets, you know. Some awful revelation of obscenity is going to be there. Oh, boy, I'll tell you, one night I'm in the phone booth, and there's a guy in the next booth. And really, I didn't know whether to run out and get a cop or not. This guy gets on the phone, and it's all excited. You know, phone booths are very tricky. They give you a sense of privacy that is really very much of an illusion. And I'm in this phone booth, and the guy next to me, it's right down here on Times Square in the Liggett's drugstore, he starts yelling, and it turns out that he is in the pot trade. Yes, and he's yelling on the phone. And he says, "Well, I told him, what do you mean? I was busted 2 months ago. What do you expect me to do now? What?
What are you talking about? How can I get that kind of dough up now? What do you mean? Tony! Tony! Don't give me Tony! How many times? And all the while, like, people walking, and I see this fuzz drifting over, you know. He's beginning to get the message. And you're, woo! And I'm waiting, you know. I figure the whole bank of phone booths are going to get busted, all of us, you know, run in. Well, today I'm standing there trying to, you know, I'm looking up in the sky, and my friend is yelling behind me, and an old lady's in the next booth, and she's screaming, and there's a young chick and another one, she's crying, you know, and it's all going on. The whole gamut of human misery. And I'm standing there, and these chicks get out of the elevator, the three nurses, and they walk towards me. And I'm first paying no attention. Well, I look, of course, there's the automatic attraction of these white uniforms. You see, one of them was fat, one of them skinny, and one of them was really high octane. Well, the little one who was high octane gives me a look right in the eyeball, and there was this sudden spark, you know, all of a sudden there was the unmistakable glint there, you know, that it just, that it kindled, and all of a sudden she says, "Hello, doctor." What? Me? Yeah, me, see, me. I realized then it was a case of mistaken identity. I suspect it's my beard and my wonderful, humane, benign appearance that makes her do this, you see, this great humane look. And I looked at her, and she says, "Hello, doctor, how are things going?" And with that, I says, well, hi, gee, how have you been? Well, she started to walk, and suddenly she turns, and she says, "How did it turn out?" I said, "How did it turn out?" "Oh, very well, very well." She said, "I know you, I just knew you would pull it off. I just had faith in you." Oh, boy, and, you know, she's just got that look. And suddenly I saw myself as this majestic brain surgeon. I have just done this spectacularly difficult operation. I have removed one complete lobe from one of the greatest atomic scientists of the world. I've tied all the sutures together. And there she is sitting up there in the balcony cheering. She says, "I knew you'd pull it off. I had faith in you." And I said, "Well, you know." I did. "What could you say? You know." I said, "Well, thank you very much." And I played it very good. I said, "Thank you very much." And she said, "Gee, it's good to see you. You know, I could see she wanted to carry out, she wanted to make a scene here, you know, and obviously there had been something going on between this chick and this doctor. I could just see it. You know, a man knows the look in the eye, right, Ed?" And here, it was me, you know, old me. And she says, gee, it's good to see you, doctor. It really is good to see you. Do you come in often anymore? I hardly ever see you around here. It's good to see you." And I said, "Well, it's very good to see you. I'm trying to think, what should I call her? Betty or dear or girl or what is it? You know, it's good to see you." And my friend is in the next room, you know, and all of a sudden he opens the door, bloop, he slams it, "Got a nickel, for God's sake, you got a nickel." So whoever it is going to hang up on him, you see, and then you hear the little phone go, dung, 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 it's going, "Give me a nickel, will you?" I say, here, and I give him a nickel, and by that time Betty's looking kind of funny, you know, and I give the guy a nickel, "Get your boing, boing, boing." Well, I turn back, and she says, "Well, doctor," she says, "Doctor, gee, it really was wonderful, wonderful to see you, and just great to see you." And they go into those big glass swinging doors, and I could see her talking to these two nurses, and they look back with great looks of admiration in their eyes, and they make the corner turn and into Rikers. Well, I want to tell you, I felt 30 feet high. 30 feet high. I could see myself pulling impossible patients through impossible, terrible, debilitating diseases. I just sort of stood there, and out my friend, he is purple in the face by now, and his eyeballs are sweating, and he's yelling. I can hear his throat gruff and screaming. He comes out of the phone booth, and he looks at me, and he says, "What's the matter with you? You have a funny look on your face." See, it was carrying over. You know how a flywheel, the mad carries over. I said, "What's the matter, Jack? What's the matter? I've got this nutty look in my eye, I suppose, you know, the great brain surgeon there." And he says, "What's the matter?" I said, "Oh, boy, wow. Oh, man, what a couple. Oh, boy." With that, I said to him, "How about a cup of coffee, huh? Would you like a cup of coffee?" He said, "I don't have any time. For God's sake, I don't have any time. Quick, let's get out and get a cab." And we're out on the street, and he's yelling and running around for cabs. And 30 seconds later, I'm on my way uptown. He's, "Oh, boy, what?" And I just sat there with my old eyeballs going, you know, "Scalpel, please. Searcher, 3 degrees more oxygen." And there is Betty. Lovely Betty in her lovely little white uniform, great blue eyes of admiration and romance. The savior of the human race, me. Well, it's a funny thing. I'm in this cab, and there was a nagging sense of recognition. You know what is it, recognition? Recognition that something like this had happened to me before. And it was an emotion. And I finally let this guy out, and I went on, and I finally got off the cab, and I'm walking by, and it hit me like a shot. Boom! I know when it was. I really do. You know, one of the things about doing the kind of show that I do every night, night after night, is you get to be the world's most analyzed man. I mean, the world's most completely analyzed. Oh, by the way, speaking of analyzed, before we go any further and to allay any confusion, starting the 10th of February, and this is official, starting the 10th of February, the time of our show, the time of me, is going to be moved from this time to 1 hour earlier, 10:15 to 11. And the reason this is so is because in the past 6 or 7 months, or certainly in the last 3 or 4 years even, about one out of every two letters come in, and people all say, if you could be on 1 hour earlier. And that's what we've done. So from now on, beginning the 10th of February, we will be on the air from 10:15 until 11, which will enable a lot of people who can only hear us on the weekends, can once in a while drop in on Wednesday. Now, if you know anybody else who listens who will not hear this, mention it to them. Because you know what's going to happen? People are very funny about radio. I will meet guys on the street 1 year after we have made the change. Guys who have listened for like 9 years. You see, and say, what happened to you? You're not on the air anymore. What happened to you? and this is the most interesting one. 1.5 years from now, I will meet guys who will swear that they hear me every night at 11:15. Every night. There are guys I meet on the street today who claim that they hear me at 4 a.m. They do. They say, oh, you're on all night, aren't you? I have been on all night since I was a pup, and I was losing my milk teeth. Well, anyway, speaking of milk teeth, I have to finish the story because it was a wild scene. I'm sitting then in an office trying to look very official. And have you ever sat and listened to a scheme by guys that are outlining a scheme to you, and you know it's balderdash and a yard wide, and nothing is ever going to come of it, and somehow you're caught up in it, and you're saying, yeah, yeah, and then what we'll do is we'll call, and it's just like you're playing some nutty Monopoly game, and you're trying to pretend, and you find yourself being dragged into it, and everybody's running in and out with papers. Yeah, I'll tell you what we do. I called Joe, and I got Joe on the phone, and listen, I'll tell you what we'll do. Let's call Ashley Steiner. We'll call William Morris. And it's, and I'm sitting in one of these things, and I'm trying to play the game. You know, I'm trying to go along with what's going on. I have no interest at all in it because this thing is bugging me. Where did I have this emotion before? The scene of the girl. The scene of the nurse, yeah. And it had nothing to do with the girl. I knew that. You know, you start separating it. No, it had something to do with something else. It was mistaken identity. That's what it was. It was somehow being given rank. That's what it is. And I'm sitting there, and these guys are listening. They're trying to talk. I said, that's what it is. It's right. I know what it is. Ah! Well, I leave the guys immediately, and I'm walking down the street, and I'm thinking back one of the great moments in my time. It happened, Ed, when I was in the Army. And the Army, of course, does a lot of things to people. And one of the things that it does to people, I think, more than anything else, it gives guys in general, it gives you two feelings. And the two feelings are really supposedly at war with one another, and I think they really are. One feeling is a peculiar sense of anonymity, a kind of sense of being molded into a great mass, a kind of sense of being put into a gigantic marching phalanx where you somehow have no responsibility, you're just in this big thing. And it's a kind of feeling of warmth and being enclosed and the whole bit. All right, now that's the one thing that you get in being in the Army. And anybody who's been in the Army recognizes that strange feeling, especially if you've been in more than a couple of years, and you begin to be really assimilated into it. Then the other part of the Army, of course, is the opposite of that. You have a sense of being erased. You have a sense of somebody has taken a pencil, the eraser, and they've just erased your name off the roll of humanity, and they've written down 16098946. U.S. Army Reserve, period. That's it, that's it. And more than that, even the number is chopped up when they make it into a PIN number. So you're at war all the time. There is the one side of you that says, gee, this is great. No responsibility. And the other side, look at me, I'm a nothing. And so you have these two things that are constantly battling within you in the Army. Well, one night, I am in West Palm Beach. And this was at the very height of war. Absolutely. I don't know whether many of you actually remember being in America and being in the Army and being in a wartime town in the very peak of war. But it's a very strange experience. And West Palm Beach at that time, since the ocean is right there, and the Germans were right offshore all the time. And there was constant spying, and they were bringing in. Occasionally they would find spies they were putting on the beach and all that stuff. It was really on a wartime footing, genuinely. It was blackouts every night, that kind of scene. And so I am in town one night with a buddy of mine named Nash. Nash is another story, but oh boy. Have you ever known a guy who, when he gets one drink, turns into King Kong, and he's actually Mr. Peepers? And you keep holding him by the neck. Don't do it, don't, Nash. And Nash is trying to beat up this Marine who's 9 feet tall. And, you know, and you hate to walk around the street and pick up feet and teeth, you know, and ears and all that, and bring Nash back in a bag, you know, and in a duffel sack. Well, he was that kind of a guy, you know. He's a very scared guy. But, boy, all he needed was one tiny drink of corn liquor, which is, he was from Nashville. Nash, he was always saying, I'm looking for some real good corn liquor. And I'd say, no, Nash, no, let's get a Coke. Nash said, what do you mean, man, a Coke? Well, invariably, it wound up with Nash trying to fist fight a lamppost. He really would. He would take on buildings. He would fight automobiles. He'd hit him with his fist. He'd get mad. He'd say, what are you looking at? And he'd go up and hit a Buick. So it was that kind of a scene. Well, one night, Nash and I were in town, and it was one of those unusual nights when Nash has kept sober. We've gone to the show, we've gone everything, and there was one last bus, Ed, one last bus, and we were in a camp. This has to be explained. There was a camp right next to West Palm Beach that was in the jungle, literally in the jungle, way set back. And it was a very secret camp. They had more security guards, they had more security measures than they have today, probably in the main chart room at the Pentagon, because it was a radar camp. And in those days, radar was extremely secret. It was like the atom bomb. And we were radar men. And so every night we'd be checked into this camp, and you had to be in absolutely on the second. If anybody was out over time, believe me, he was in fantastic trouble. It was not like an ordinary camp. And if anybody was found walking around the camp at night, they had special hours when you could walk, special areas you could walk in, and all kinds of things. Very, very secret. And every night, the camp was absolutely blacked out. They turn out all the lights by a big master switch, even in the barracks. Everything was black. Well, it was that kind of camp. Well, it was 1 o'clock in the morning. We were supposed to be in no later than if we had a pass. 1 a.m. Now, the last bus leaving for camp left at something like maybe 12:30, something 12:32, something like that, and it got in about 5 minutes before the 1 o'clock whistle blew. You would get through the gate, you'd show them your pass, you'd walk along the pathway, and you'd arrive at your barracks. But you had to carry that pass, man. And when you got there, pow, that was it, man. That was it. You did not leave the barracks. Well, Nash and I go to see the movie. We sit, and I can even tell you what the movie was, in case it's interesting to you. The movie, I don't know why I remember these details, but the movie was Laura, with Clifton Webb and Dana Andrews and Gene Tierney. And so we sat through Laura, and we're sitting there, we're enjoying it. And on the way back to the bus station, we went to the early show, you see, so we're going to make sure. So we are waiting in line for the bus. And it is now about midnight. The bus is not going to leave for another half hour. We're the first guys in line. I wonder how many guys remember this about the South. We are the absolute first guys in line for the bus. And we figure, well, you know, we've got it made. So we're waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting. And the line is forming up behind us until finally there's a line of about maybe 100 people waiting for the bus, civilians and everything. You know, this was the bus that went out in the country and dropped people off in little places. It would be the equivalent of Fort Lee, Hackensack, Teaneck, and that, you know. So we're waiting in line, and there's all kinds of Florida crackers and stuff behind us, and it's hot and steamy, and we're sweating, and we're going to go back, and the place is blacked out, and the only little avenue of light is this little bus station. We're waiting there. Well, the bus comes in, and it's a Southern pre-war bus, one of these big high ones with about 25 seats, and it comes ding, 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 it comes blah, 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 shh. It stops, and the guy gets out, opens the door, and of course, there is me. There I am, right in the first line, and me and Nash are waiting. He opens the door, and just like that, two MPs jump out, just step right forward, and say, hey, get in the rear line, you guys. We're privates, get in the rear of the line. The point is there were about nine lieutenants, there were about nine majors, and a couple of captains back there, you see. And we had to get to the back of the line. I said, what do you mean, back of the line? Well, get back of the line, Mac. Well, this guy fingers his club, and another guy fingers his gun, and another guy takes a look at me, and Nash is standing there, little tiny Nash. Well, we turn, we get in the back of the line. Well, I don't have to tell you. They fill the bus up. And there must have been 15 people left, including guess who? And it was the kind of camp, believe me, if you arrived there, it was like jail. I mean, it was like jail if you overstayed your leave. So both of us rush out into this pitch-black highway and start frantically to hitchhike. We are hitchhiking like mad, hitchhiking. Cars are going past us in the dark with a little blackout light, you know. Ooh, they go, ooh, oh, my God. Ooh, ooh. And suddenly along came a rickety 1941 Ford convertible, just barreling sideways down the road. We're so out of line. And it stops. Hey, get in here, you guys. Come on, soldier, get in here. Well, we go climbing in, and sitting in the front seat of this little Ford convertible are two second lieutenants, bag to the ears. They are squiffed right out of there. And, you know, we're two little privates. We sit in the back. Hey, man. Hey, how about some of this corn? And I thought, oh, my God, if they give Nash a slug of this corn liquor. Hey, man. Hey, how about it? Come on, let's go, boy. Well, Nash, of course, smelling this like a bird dog, he's sitting in the back there. He grabs a hold of the corn liquor. And he takes one big slug, and we're sitting in the back, and I'm holding Nash. Now, easy, boy, easy, boy. Well, it took about 14 milliseconds for this to operate on Nash. And one of the big second lieutenants turns around, and he says, hey, boy, what outfit are you in? There's a slight pregnant pause, and Nash says, none of your damn business, lieutenant. Well. And the lieutenant says, what do you say? He's none of your damn business. What do you know about it? And the lieutenant says, what are you talking about, you little squirt? You little squirt, what do you mean? And Nash says, you take them bars off, you, and I'll knock you down to your size. Well, with that, I said, can I get out? I live here. And I get out on the street, and this car goes down, and I could see yelling and hollering all the way on down. And I stood there and hitchhiked and hitchhiked and hitchhiked. I arrived at camp at 11:15 the next day, 3 days in the guardhouse.